Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Peter Hessler, whose latest book is Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. Peter Hessler has written two other books, Oracle Bones and Rivertown. He's been the China correspondent for The New Yorker magazine, has written for The New York Times, National Geographic, several other places. He's back in the United States now, but maintains a home still in China. This book has three different parts, three different areas that you talk about, and it concerns the entire time that you were in China as a correspondent from about 2000 up until, I guess, 2007. Were you working on this book separately or as part of your articles?
As I researched articles, I began to see a book project coming into focus. And so I tried to direct my magazine work in a way that would allow me to continue researching this.
Well, the first section concerns a trip you took, a driving trip along the Great Wall. And this was originally written for National Geographic in some form?
I did a magazine story for National Geographic. Yeah, I researched that in 2001, 2002. But it was just a short magazine article, and I spent more than 2 months out on the road, and so I really wanted to expand this. And then I did a lot of other research on the automobile in China, which just sort of provides the background for that story.
Well, it starts by you're renting a car. I think it's from Capital Motors, I think.
Yeah, in Beijing.
In Beijing, and they were owned by the government, and they didn't really care how dinged up it got.
Yeah, those guys were sort of classic characters. I mean, they were really friendly. You rent a car, and you have to. The first thing you do, they have a diagram of the car, and you walk around the whole thing and you document all of the dents that are pre-existing, and then when you bring it back you go back around the car, and if there's anything new then you pay them, you know, usually a few bucks for the new dents. But they were very forgiving, and as Beijing drivers have to be.
Well, you didn't exactly stay within their rules.
No, they had rules that you weren't supposed to leave Beijing, and I made an executive decision that didn't apply to me, so I ended up driving their vehicle, which was a Chinese-made Jeep Cherokee. I drove it all the way to the Tibetan Plateau, and when I brought it back and they saw the mileage on the odometer, they were actually excited. They were happy that I'd had a good adventure. So these guys weren't too concerned about what I was doing with their vehicle.
You brought it back with the exact amount of gas that was in it before, which was like 1/8 of a tank?
Yeah, it was never the same. I mean, it was always, you know, sometimes they'd have 3/4 of a tank, sometimes half a tank. They had 3/8 of it. I mean, it was really hard. And I tried to convince them. I mean, I said, you know, in America, they rent it full and you bring it back full. And they said, well, nobody in China would do that. Nobody would do that. And I said, well, if you make them pay a lot of money, if they don't do it, then they will. And they said, no, you don't understand, Chinese people won't do it. So this is like so many things in China. It's a new industry. People haven't done this before. The idea of renting a car was totally foreign 5 years before I started doing this, you know. And so everybody figures it out on the fly. And I was doing the same thing.
If I were to pick one salient feature of the entire book, Country Driving, from beginning to end, it's the change that's happened in China between 2001, when you first began your journeys by car, up until when you left 2007, 2008. The entire country was changing. Villages were being abandoned.
That first journey was across the north. You know, a couple of things that really jumped out at me. And the main thing was every village I would stop in, these are very small places, farming communities. The people say, you know, our population has dropped by 50% usually. And all of the young people are leaving to find jobs in the coastal regions and the factories and construction crews.
Because you spoke Chinese, some of them thought you were Chinese.
Yeah, this hadn't happened to me in other situations. By the time I took this trip, I lived in China for 5 years. I could spoken Chinese. But because I was driving this vehicle by myself, people sort of figured I must belong in some respect. And so I'd pick up a lot of hitchhikers, and they would often say, you know, are you Chinese, or are you Mongolian, or are you Uyghur? You know, sometimes they were trying to figure out where I belonged.
This is supposedly kind of a totalitarian society, or at least that's the impression we get. Yet there's a certain amount of lawlessness throughout. You were pretty brazen in not reporting on your own whereabouts, and when you got caught, they just sent you on your way.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things about China that's often hard to communicate. It's an authoritarian country. You know, the Communist Party's in charge. But there are many aspects of life where you feel, you know, it feels pretty chaotic. And there was a Wild West atmosphere in the capitalism and in so many elements. And, I mean, that's why the cover of the book has a picture of a statue of a cop. And this is one of the things I realized when I started driving in China is you never see police. I mean, I kept thinking, where's the highway patrol? They didn't really have one. And so you never see cops. And I was driving through Inner Mongolia, and their strategy for directing traffic was to put up statues of cops periodically.
This is a real picture of one of
those
statues.
That's my photograph. Yeah, no, that's my photograph. And it's, you know, so this was supposed to make drivers drive slower, you know. But to me, it was symbolic. I mean, because it does say a lot about China. This is a place we think of as authoritarian. The truth is, on the ground, it has a very different feel.
The trip through the north, you saw towns where there were no people in the 20s and 30s. They'd all migrated. And I think at one point you say that 130 to 140 million people have left the countryside?
Yeah, that's the figure now. In 1978 was when Deng Xiaoping started the economic reforms that sort of created the China that we know today. And when that started, the country was 80% rural, you know, and then this is changing. It has changed ever since then. People are leaving the farms to find factory jobs, construction jobs. Yeah, 140 million have already left home.
What were these villages like?
You know, it's hard to see a future for them because most of the people that I would see were elderly people, sometimes disabled people who couldn't work, and then a lot of very small children because the migrants, the people who lived in the cities, they generally send their children back to be raised during this generation. In the future, is that going to continue? I sort of doubt it. But I don't know who's going to be in these places in 20 years.
These are small farms, but they don't own the land.
You know, China has sort of a dual economic system between urban and rural. The rules are quite different. And in urban China, you can buy and sell real estate. You can buy and sell your apartment. It's a very important thing for middle-class Chinese now. In the countryside, you can't own your land. So rural people have many fewer options to improve themselves. That's one of the reasons why they leave, I mean, because they can find better opportunities if they go to the cities.
And the cities themselves, as we'll talk about a little later on, some of these cities have grown up out of nothing. And they're just enormous factory towns.
Yeah, I mean, you have 10 million people every year leaving the countryside. This is a huge source of population. These places are all expanding. You know, all cities in China are booming. If you lived in a place 10 years ago and you go back today, it's guaranteed to be different in China.
In an interview, you said that somebody asked you to compare what was going on to the Midwest, where you grew up, and you said you couldn't compare. The only thing I could think of was Butte, Montana, which went from nothing to a town of 100,000 people because of the mines, and then they all left at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain periods in our history and in the history of the West. For example, in England and in Europe, when you had industrialization, there's a lot of writing about villages emptying out and people going back to the village and realizing that it's dying. One difference is that in China, this has happened a lot faster. You know, this has really been a 20-year change, something that happened over, you know, period of most of a century in the West.
If you were to go back today, what kind of changes would you see even in the 3 years since you left?
You know, most of these places, you would see significant change. The small village where I still have a home, I talk to my neighbors there on the phone quite a bit, and there's always something that's being built. They have some public buildings there now. There's other people from the city who have moved in and built houses. There's talk of building a road over the mountain. So, you know, it moves forward. People expect it to move forward there. It doesn't disorient them in the way that it would disorient us, actually.
Well, Peter Hessler, the second part of your book is the most personal part because it's about your own life, getting a home in a place called Sansha, is that correct?
Yeah.
Which is a couple hours outside of Beijing?
Yeah, when I started renting a home there, it was a little more than 2 hours, and a fairly rough drive. The end of the road was dirt, was not paved, very quiet farming village. You know, it felt like a different world from Beijing, which is why I went out there, just to sort of have a different, you know, and have an escape, actually, from the city. To give some perspective on how sort of timeless this place felt, I mean, there was no place to spend money there. There was no business of any sort, and there was no market, no shop, no restaurant. There were still two old women who had bound feet who lived in the village. There were people in the village who had never even been to Beijing. So it felt sleepy, you know, in those days.
You were going to get one place from somebody who you call the kicker. Who you never name, I guess, for good reason, because he doesn't come across too well.
Well, he's an interesting person. I mean, this is somebody who, when I first went to the village, I looked at a couple of homes. Because at that time, in 2001, it was very easy to rent a home in the countryside because everybody was leaving. So lots of empty houses.
How much did you wind up paying a month?
My friend and I paid $40 a month rent, and this is for two of us, or $20 a month for, you know, a view of the Great Wall.
Well, no wonder you can keep the place.
Yeah. I mean, we just rebuilt it, so we're paying a little more than that, but it's not American real estate standards. But, yeah, when I first went there, two people offered me buildings to rent, and one of them was not very good, and I just said, oh, thanks, you know, I don't want it. But it turned out that he was very angry about that, and he caused a lot of problems for me. He'd call the police when I would come in, and you know, basically got me kicked out of the village for a period of a year where I negotiated with the cops to figure out a way to stay.
And eventually you wound up in a place that was owned by people who were no longer there, but managed by a man named Wei Zichi and his wife.
Cao Chunmei, yeah.
Okay, and they have a son who you helped raise for several years. In fact, he had an illness, and you took him to the hospital at one point.
He was sort of the only little kid in the village, actually. I mean, because in this village, most people had migrated, and they had usually, in this part of the country, they had usually brought their children with them when they moved to the city.
Now, this village is located at the top of a mountain. I couldn't quite get
that. Yeah, it's, okay. You know, it's pretty high up. I mean, it's a couple thousand feet high, whereas Beijing is close to sea level. So it has quite a different climate. You know, it's a lot cooler than Beijing. One of the reasons that I liked going out there. But this little boy, Wei Jiao was his name. When I moved out there, he was about four. And we got to know the family very well, my friend and I. And then when he became ill, it turned out he had sort of a rare blood condition that was actually quite dangerous for a period and sort of life-threatening. And I tried to help the family. We sort of worked together to try to get him medical care during that period.
Here we've got a country that's supposedly a communist country, and yet there's no health care, particularly for the peasants. There's nothing.
You know, again, it's one of these contradictions. We talked about how it's an authoritarian country, but there's often no sense of authority. China's a communist country, but it's often very capitalistic and pretty dog-eat-dog, and there's not a lot of social support in many aspects of life. This is especially true in the countryside. When it comes to health care, there's no nationalized health care in China, and they're trying to do something about this. There are proposals, but, you know, it's a bigger project than our health reform. And so you're not covered in rural China. This is one reason why people in the countryside have traditionally, if they have money, they save it, because they know if they have a medical crisis, they're going to have to pay cash. And in this case, for example, this boy needed a transfusion, or he was, you know, at risk of dying, and he was not going to get that blood until they put the cash on the table at the hospital. You got to pay cash.
And there's no insurance. I mean, you can't get insurance.
You can get insurance if you buy it. You can get private insurance. And this family actually had bought private insurance, quite rare at that time. It's becoming a little more common now as people get more educated. These folks were quite bright, and they were smart enough to have bought an insurance policy. But even so, they had to raise cash initially to pay for his, for his medical care.
You're talking about the distinction between city and country. This is not quite class distinction. It's something else, or is it class, or what?
You know, it's all tied up together. In China, the term that they have for agricultural people is nongmin, which means literally, you know, yeah, an agricultural person is what it means. And you can translate that as farmer, or you can translate that as peasant. And in a way, the meaning is sort of both of those, because there is a very strong class distinction associated with this term. And it's a loaded term. And people in the cities look down on people from the countryside, people that they consider nongmin, you know, peasants or farmers.
And how long does it take for somebody from the countryside to be in the city to no longer be looked down upon?
It can happen pretty quick, and that's one of the things that I'm writing about in this book. In the second part about that village, the village started to change when the government paved the road, and suddenly people could drive out there, and the villagers could more easily go to the city. They began to do business, and Wei Jiqi, the father of that boy, began to engage in business, and he became quite successful. But one of the first things he did was learn to dress differently. You know, he would have certain shoes that he would wear in the city. He got a leather jacket that he would wear, so he wouldn't look like a farmer. He began to smoke. And smoke certain cigarettes that were accepted in the cities.
The whole story of the cigarettes. Now, this is something that obviously we don't have here, but it's like this hierarchy of cigarettes.
If you're a male in China doing anything sort of entrepreneurial, doing any kind of business, then you need to give out cigarettes. It's sort of the way that males communicate. And so this farmer had never smoked. He told me it was wasteful, it was expensive. He had no interest in it. But once he started doing business, he very quickly started. And he quickly got addicted to it. But he needed to do that in order to, he's going out, taking people out to dinner. He's making business contacts. That was an important part of his routine.
And in that section and in the third section, which deals with factories in the South, you're often describing particular brands of cigarettes because they imply certain things. What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, China is something like 500 different cigarette brands. I mean, and they're state-run. I mean, this is a state-subsidized, state-controlled industry. Yes, Wei Jiqi would have one type of cigarette that he would use in the village. But when he went to the city, he had different types of cigarettes because he wanted to promote a different image. When I report in China, when I was going to the factory town to report, I always carried cigarettes. I never smoke. I'm a distance runner. The last thing I want to do is smoke. But it's awkward if you're talking to people, and especially if you're talking to businessmen, and you can't offer them a smoke. I carried Zhonghua. That was the brand I carried. My photographer, who was Chinese-American, he had a different brand that he carried because he thought that was more appropriate to his image. So you think these things through sort of carefully.
Well, how do you choose a cigarette brand based upon your image?
Well, you know, I figured as as a white guy, I sort of had to go with one of the better brands, basically. And so I chose Zhonghua, which is something that a lot of businessmen smoke down there. My friend's Chinese American. He thought he wanted a more mellow persona, and so he chose a different brand.
Well, when you were in the north, you often didn't find places to sleep, and you just slept out in the wild?
Yeah, when I was driving across northern China, I mean, that was technically something I wasn't supposed to do. As a reporter, you're supposed to register and apply before you go somewhere. And I was often in remote areas where they're not crazy about having a foreigner around. And in China, if you go to a hotel, you're supposed to register. And the registration forms, they look at your passport. It says that you're a journalist, if you're a registered journalist, as I was. And they tell the cops. And so my solution to that issue was just to bring a tent. And so I usually camped, you know, which was great anyway, because these are beautiful. The landscapes are beautiful. Wide open scenery. It's easy to find a place to sleep.
And what about finding food on those journeys? Were there restaurants in the towns?
The towns usually had a place to eat, you know, and so usually I'd be able to go through somewhere where I at least had a little noodle restaurant or something. I carried food in my Jeep in case I didn't find something.
And water?
That's the main thing. I had plenty of water because I was often in desert areas.
Is the water safe to drink there? Do you have to bring bottled?
I would usually buy bottled water. The people themselves would boil water, but usually when you're on the road, I just pick up a bunch of bottled water and keep it in the back of my Jeep.
These days, what's it like in terms of buying food, packaged food? Are there 7-Elevens like there are in Thailand?
There's some 7-Elevens in Beijing, not tons of them. Buying things in China generally is not hard, you know, I mean, especially in urban areas. I mean, these are people who know how to sell things. And so if there's a need for it, it's out there, you know, and there's a lot of entrepreneur activity. As you get further west, it's harder, you know, and I write in the book about how I reach a certain point and you couldn't get Coke anymore or things like that. You know, you kind of get the cheap Chinese version of Coke.
Well, that was in 2001, that first trip. I would guess it's changed in the past 8 years.
Yeah. And this book starts, the research began in 2001 when I got my driver's license, and it continued all the way until 2009. Yeah, I mean, it's night and day. These places, you know, the networks for things to be sold are totally different now from what they were then. And the roads are different. I mean, there's been a huge construction boom going on with highways and rural roads. And so it's a lot easier to make this kind of journey now.
Now there are restaurants and shops in Santra?
Yeah. I mean, that was a big change in the place. When I went out there, there was no restaurant, no shop. There wasn't any place you could spend money. They would have a truck would come up once or twice a week and just with market goods in the back, and people could buy stuff and the truck would go away. But once they paved the road and they started to have this new contact with the city, and then meanwhile in Beijing, people started to buy cars in greater numbers. They began to explore the countryside. So people in the village began to do business, and they opened up restaurants and guest houses. And so there was quite a bit of entrepreneur activity now in that place.
What about basic utilities, electricity, water, garbage? Had that changed over the years?
They always had those things. When I moved in, we had a phone line. We had pretty consistent electricity.
And cell phone action. You could always
There was no cell phone action at the beginning, actually. And that was a big moment in the village. Maybe 3 years after I moved there, they got a cell phone tower. So every year you'd see changes like this. And they got cable television another year. But one of the big changes you notice is that people started to buy packaged goods. You know, because they had never had that kind of food before. They would raise their own food and they farmed. But then they began to buy things from, you know, that city people eat. And they never had a garbage system in the town. So they would just throw it in the creek, basically. And it started to fill up with styrofoam and plastic wrappers. And so after I'd been there for about 6 years, they finally had to institute a garbage cleanup. And in the book I write about, this is sort of the moment when you know they've arrived. You know, this is when you know that they are a modern, prosperous place, when they've got so much trash that they've got to cart it out.
Television, what kind of television did they have at that time when you started, and how did that change?
When I started, you know, I think they had 3 or 4 channels, but then after a few years they got cable TV with about 70 channels. And, you know, the farmers liked to watch certain programs, and they had all these exposés, because I would eat with the family. And in China, when they get a new television and 70 channels, it means it's going to be on all the time. It never goes off. And so we'd eat, and TV is always on. And I end up watching these programs, so it's amazing the stuff they watch. Like, they would have these exposé programs about fake goods. I remember eating one meal and there was about fake railroad tickets. And then a week later I was eating with them and there was an expose on fake cooking oil. And the next week it was fake salt. And you're thinking, who makes fake salt? You know, what's the profit margin there on knocking off salt? But there's somebody doing it, you know, and they're exposing it on CCTV.
Did you get any American channels?
No, there's no American. I mean, sometimes you'd get a foreign show that's been translated. Nothing that I recognize, though. There was some weird kid show that was on. There was a lot of Ultraman. I don't know if you remember that old cartoon that sort of, I don't know, when I was a kid, people used to watch a Japanese cartoon. That became huge in China. The little boy, he would watch that all the time. All the kids in his class watch that. So it's odd, the stuff that comes in.
When we think of China, we think also of a lot of propaganda and loudspeakers going on. This one time where you mentioned the loudspeakers, and it came as a kind of shock because we don't normally consider just life with loudspeakers.
Yeah, and the Chinese increasingly don't have this. I mean, most Chinese do not live in this. And this village was a little bit of a throwback in that they still had loudspeakers that would go three times a day with news, you know, and it would be, you know, pretty early. I mean, it starts like at 6:30 or 7, depending on the season. And then you get a noon one, then you get an evening one. And it's all, you know, political news. It just blares through the valley.
And the effect of the Communist Party and the cadres, that's something that it's a completely different reality than we're used to here, I guess. I mean, the communists, they may not be communists, but they still run things.
They certainly do. You know, and in this village, you had a much stronger sense of that authority than you would in the city. You know, in the third part of the book, when I'm in the factory town, the party has less of a direct presence. But in the village, you know where their power is because certain people in the village are party members, and the party members are the ones who are running the show. In China, it's pretty hard to join the Communist Party. Only about 5% of the population is a member. And so when I write about Wei Jiqi, the man, you know, my neighbor, he became a businessman. The first thing he did once he got successful was join the Communist Party, which does seem weird. Now he's a capitalist. He's the richest guy in the village. Why does he need the Communist Party? Well, he has to protect his status. So that was a political move.
Is the party secretary, the female party secretary, is she still running the show then?
Yep. They just had an election. I just talked with Wei Jiqi, and they had another election, and she was this time unopposed. And, you know, he learned his lesson. He tried to become the highest official, and he was turned down, basically, by the higher levels made sure that things remain stable in this village. It was a lesson to me in how politics works in China.
There's constant reference to a word, guanxi?
Guanxi, yeah.
Yeah. What is guanxi?
Guanxi means relationships, connections, basically, and this is what a Chinese businessman needs. And for Wei Jiqi, once he shifted from farming to business, he needed to protect his guanxi. And in China, the term they have is la guanxi, which means to pull guanxi, to, you know, get almost like you're attracting it towards yourself. And that's why he smoked cigarettes and distributed cigarettes. It's why he would give gifts. He'd have banquets with people. It's a type of networking and very male-dominated in China.
Well, that was another thing I was going to ask you about, because when we think of communist countries in quotes, like Russia during its USSR days, we do think that there was a certain equality of the sexes. Yet in China, not at all.
You know, in a way, it's impressive. I mean, for example, women work in China. That's not even questioned. I mean, every woman you know, whether she has a child or not, is working. And so they're expected to work. They have a lot of opportunities. But you do tend to see more of the power with males. You know, in the village, it was quite dramatic, you know, because the main authority figures tended to be male. In families, it tended to be the man who was, you know, who was calling the shots. The thing that was interesting about that place is there was one woman who had risen, and she was the party secretary, the highest official. She was very tough, really capable. But that's an anomaly. You know, that's not the common story in China.
Well, what did she say to you every time you came into the village?
She'd say, oh, did you just get here?
Well, obviously not in English. Well, say it in Chinese. Every time?
Basically. Yeah. Yeah, she was a character. I mean, I sort of admired her. I never trusted her. And I knew that she was somewhat ambivalent about whether I was there as well. And she had the power to get me out. But she was very capable, and the villagers respected her. So it shows that it's not impossible for women to rise in this society. And actually, you know, it is in some ways a much more equal society than it was before the communists came to power. But men do tend to be the ones who are networking, have the guanxi, have the power.
This section of the book, so this middle section, I mean, the first section, I could see you were working on it, but you already had the basics from the National Geographic. The second section, when did you actually write it?
Oh, I didn't write it, you know, until I moved back to the States. I mean, I wrote this whole book after I left China and moved to the States. I went back to China for a couple of follow-up trips to do reporting. But I was in the village. I mean, I was there for 6 years before I started writing that part of the book, you know.
Had you written about that family before?
I wrote about them in The New Yorker. I did two stories in The New Yorker. But, you know, neither of those stories was particularly long. And the thing I like about books is you can bring a new depth to it. And also structurally, you have so many opportunities as a writer to do interesting things with your structure and with your voice.
As you were living this, was it something in the back of your mind going, I'm really going to write about this in depth at some point?
In the village, I didn't feel that until we had this experience where the boy became sick. And I was involved with the family in trying to get health care. It was a very intense 2 weeks. It was the first time I'd seen that sort of situation and was personally involved in it. And I felt like after that I wanted to write about it. And so my framework sort of changed at that point.
Now, the third part of the book, at what point did you realize that it was going to be a book? And was that particular section in the South, was the research for this book at that point?
Yeah. Basically, I took that first long drive across the north of China. And after that, I realized, you know, this is great. And I could probably just write a book about this trip, but I want to focus in on something as well. And so I decided I want to focus in on a village or some region in northern China. And so the first part is a journey. The second part is about a place and a place in transition. As I worked on that project, I realized if I want this to be a full book that really tells something about today's China, I need to have something about urban China and this new factory economy. And so for the third section of the book, I decided, okay, how can I continue this story and find a way to bring urban China, you know, into my vision of what's going on here? How can I report this? And so I decided to find a new highway. I drove along the route of a highway that was being built in southeastern China, and I chose a city that was in the process of building a big factory district.
Was that just at random?
It was directed in the sense that I chose this route along a highway that was connecting to the coast, because I knew that traditionally once a place has a connection to the coast and to a port, then the economy changes fast. And while I was working on that, I was talking to National Geographic, and so I did that as a National Geographic story. But the final goal was to use it as a third part in this book.
And how did you meet up with Boss Gao and Boss Wang? Because you focus on their bra implement factory.
Yeah, I mean, when I do projects like this, I try not to direct things too early. You know, and basically, I like the idea of taking a survey approach. You see what's out there and you make your choices. And so the first trip I took was all along that route of that expressway, visiting, you know, dozens of towns. And then at the end of that two-week journey, I chose one of them. Lishui was the name of this small town. And then the second time I went back about a month and a half later, and I spent more than 2 weeks in Lishui just talking to all kinds of people, construction workers and businessmen and migrants. And I had the idea actually that I would follow a construction crew. But I happened to encounter these two bosses who were in the process of designing their factory, and I ended up just watching them do that, and then I followed them for the next 2 years, and that became the focus of this book.
Did you live in the town at any time, or were you just going back and forth and making phone calls?
I was still living in Beijing, and so I would go down about once a month. I worked out a deal with a local hotel where I could get a good rate on a room, and so I'd be down there for a week or 2 weeks at a time. And do reporting and then go back home.
At what point in this did you get married?
What point did I get married? We didn't really have a wedding, so it's hard to say. I got married in 2006, around the time, right after Oracle Bones came out. I was just starting the last part of this book, Lishui. I was just starting to research that. My wife had actually been working on a lot of research in the far south of China, so we were both working in kind of factory areas.
How did you meet her?
In Beijing, through mutual friends. We're both reporters and writers, and so it was pretty natural.
Leslie's a member.
Yeah.
The two of you were going down to this town together then?
No. She was working in the far south of China in a place called Dongguan, which is down near Hong Kong. That's a different type of factory economy. And I worked in Zhejiang province, which is in the east, sort of closer to Shanghai.
Were you comparing notes?
Certainly. And you learn a lot when you talk to somebody else who's doing this. And it's interesting because your perspective is very different. You know, she's a Chinese-American woman, and she focused a lot on the young girls in the dormitories and following their experiences. It's the kind of reporting. I couldn't do that. I would never be able to get as close to these girls as Leslie did. And so that's a perspective that I couldn't get. But the way that I followed these bosses and hung out with these guys and their head machinists, you know, it's a very male world. And that's something that Leslie would have more trouble doing. So I think it's sort of different perspectives on the same thing.
There's a family called the Tao family. And a young girl, I think she's 16, she lies about her age. And soon the whole family is coming in. I'm sure you discussed that with Leslie.
Certainly.
Did she have any different take on it than you did?
No, I mean, I think Leslie's conclusions about this economy and the migrants, it's pretty similar to the way I felt about it, which is that it's a tough world. I think there's a lot of situations that we would think of as exploitative. But it's also true that people are highly motivated and amazingly capable. And these young people who go into this economy very quickly learn to manage themselves. And they're really good negotiators. They don't have the traditional negotiating tools that we think of. Like, they don't have unions that are independent. They don't have, you know, laws that they really can depend on. But they find ways to negotiate. The family you mentioned, they basically found a way to get all of the people in their family working in a factory, and then they would negotiate as a group. And they had a lot of power. You know, and the 15-year-old, who was not even legal to be working, she had a lot of power because she was a very good worker. the bosses wanted to keep her on.
You followed the factory from its origins to its eventual move to a different place. Is the factory going on now? I mean, did they make it?
Yep. When I first met these guys, they had been making the little wire that supports underneath a brassiere, and their goal was to move up in the world and make a more sophisticated product, and the one they chose is the little ring that bra straps go through, which to us is sort of a laughable thing, but it's actually technically fairly complicated, and there's a high profit margin.
You mentioned the fact that each of these different towns, they seem to focus on one little item. A bottle cap.
Yeah, this is something that's happened in that part of Zhejiang, in that there have been areas that tend to do one product. Like Wenzhou, a big city near the coast, is famous for making cigarette lighters. They make 70% of the world's cigarette lighters come from this one town in China. And then you have a place called Qiaotou, which has over 380 button factories in one basically very small town. And everybody there makes buttons, you know. And I went to another place named Wuyi, which makes playing cards, you know, 5 billion decks a year. It's unbelievable. You drive through these places and you have all these one-product towns.
Well, you also have people, older people, who have lived through everything from the years before Mao, maybe even the Japanese occupation, then through Mao, then through the Cultural Revolution, and then through what happened in 1978. What's left of a sense of history?
I think people have a lot of trouble processing it. And I think generally this generation in China is not focused on the past. You don't hear people talk about it. You know, they don't talk about the bad experiences they went through in the Cultural Revolution. They would prefer to think about today and, you know, and to sort of focus on the here and now.
It's a comment you made in an interview. I don't see this place being China as an incredible juggernaut or that they're doing better than everyone else. And there's a lot of fear in America that China is going to be the next great power, but from reading the book, they're quite a ways from that. They're still in frontier world.
I think so. I mean, they become very good at making labor-intensive, low-margin products. And, I mean, there's a lot of fear in America about Chinese taking our jobs. I mean, I'm watching these people on an assembly line, a very simple job, managing these bra rings. They're making 40 cents an hour. I don't think an American can compete with that, but I don't think an American wants to. I mean, we are not going to be able to compete with China on labor-intensive factories, you know, labor-intensive jobs. But, you know, the U.S. basically and the West, the advantage that these places have always had is that they're good at innovation, they're good at efficiency, and that's because of actually a shortage of labor, you know, and that's kind of what inspired the technical revolutions of the Industrial Revolution or in America, you know, the assembly line, the American system of standardization. They responded to a shortage of labor. China has the opposite problem. They have so much labor that there's a temptation to make very cheap, low-margin products, and that's what I'm observing in that southern town.
It also means that you're seeing less automation because there's no reason. The automation is more expensive than keeping the workers on.
It sort of dulls the innovation, you know, the incentive to save labor, you know, and so many technical improvements come from the opposite impulse. So I think this is an issue for China.
Peter Hessler, you also talk about localism. It seems to me as if in the book there's this vague power called the Chinese government, and they don't seem to have much idea of what's going on in the country, and they don't really care. They're just kind of clinging on to power, and what's really happening is happening locally. There's no national movements of any kind.
There is a degree of national planning. We see this in something like, for example, the highway system, which is being built at an impressive rate, and it's connecting sort of every city, over 200,000 people. They're building train lines. They're planning nuclear reactors. Those kind of things, big picture issues, you do see some planning. But when you get down to the local level, that's not coming from the central government. When I'm in a place like Lishui, their funding, for example, the government's not helping them fund. They have to raise their own funds. And so cities in China learn to find a path. And so there is a lot of autonomy in that sense.
You also talk about a village being displaced by a dam. That story that I read is no different than what we heard about the Three Gorges Dam either, except Three Gorges was much bigger.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in the Peace Corps in that region, in the Three Gorges Dam region. So this is something I've seen a couple of different times in China. They're building huge numbers of dams. And a big issue in China is electricity. When I first went to that factory town, they were having power cuts every day because they couldn't generate enough power for their plants. And so they need more power. And one way they do it is through dam building. That's why they're also proposing a lot of nuclear power plants now.
Do the two bosses that you know, or Wei Zixi, do they now have email?
They have email. They don't use it much. Okay. So those people, when I communicate with them, I have to call them. And in China, it's more the educated, highly educated people tend to have that. You know, so when I write my former students, for example, they're all on email. You know, it doesn't take much money, but it's just people who have a, you know, sort of a more standard, stable routine. Cell phone is really the key in China. And that's especially for the lower, you know, for the migrants, the factory workers, construction workers. For those people, everything revolves around their cell phone.
Is there much texting? I mean, I would think texting is kind of hard when you have a language with so many pictograms.
It's easy.
Is it really?
I mean, I can't write Chinese by hand. I can write it on a cell phone a lot better.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Any foreigner in China quickly realizes that it's really hard to write by hand, but you get a put me on a phone, I'm great. You know, so, the Chinese text all the time because they're big cell phone users, but they're very thrifty. 50 cell phone users, and that's very cheap in China to text.
What about politics following the rest of the world? Did they ever talk to you about George W. Bush or Iraq or Barack Obama or even Katrina?
Yeah, I mean, they're interested in these issues, and they see things on the news. Their take is often very different. I mean, when Katrina happened, I was in the village, and one of my neighbors, you know, he said, when that happens in America, that's actually important because those people matter. And he said, you know, if that happened in China, it would actually be a good thing. He said, you know, we could lose 100 million people and it'd be good for the country because we're overpopulated. I mean, sometimes you get this incredibly crazy take and you just don't know how to respond. I mean, I couldn't even tell. Is that a pessimistic worldview or is it incredibly optimistic? I can't even characterize it, you know.
Or is it ironic?
He was dead serious.
He's dead serious.
This is a farmer. He's just not an educated person, but he's smart and he's interested. He'd been watching news. And, yeah, that was his point. He said, you know, in America, life is valuable, but it's not valuable here in China. If we had 100 million people disappear, it'd be great for us, you know.
They value their own lives,
though. It's just a very different perspective, you know, and it's a tough place. You know, people are used to tough things happening. It's one of the reasons that they've been successful. They're willing to work hard, and they're really fearless. They're risk takers, and that's why these entrepreneurs can go into a situation with no promise and put their life savings down and try to make it work. They don't have the fear that a lot of Americans have because they have not experienced comfort for, you know, a generation.
There also doesn't seem to be much in the way of a legal system to stop them either. I mean, it's like there's a reason why every week there's a program about a scam.
Mm-hmm. Laws are in place, but it's a work in progress. And whether or not they're enforced is one issue. And it's also an imperfect system. We talked about the land use laws, you know, the difference between urban and rural. That's a problem. It should be reformed. And, you know, people are aware of this, but it's very hard to do this in a country of 1.3 billion. I think it's very hard for government officials to figure out, you know, how to fix all of these things.
When you came back to the States, how much cultural dislocation was there?
You know, kind of surprisingly little, but maybe because we had prepared for it. I mean, and we decided to do the shock therapy transition. So we moved to a town of less than 700 people in southwestern Colorado. It was one stoplight in the county. So it's not Beijing, 13 million. You know, we wanted someplace quiet to write our books. I realized how much slower things are in America when I moved back. You know, you just don't have this pace of change and sort of frenzy that you have in China. I also noticed that people are sort of gentler to each other and you know, it's a softer society in that respect. It's easier to get along and people are more patient. China can be a pretty hard place in many ways. I think it's easier for a foreigner like me. People are quite nice to me. But for Chinese people, it's a competitive, tough society. You know, they have to be on their game every day, you know, from dawn to dusk.
Well, when you were living in Beijing, were your friends mostly Americans or were you friends with a lot of locals too?
Yeah, lots of different friends. I mean, I had expat friends and then I had local friends. And I still have lots of friends from the Peace Corps. Who live in Western China in Sichuan, and of course the village where I had a home, and those are some of my closest friends in Beijing. I think probably the people that I was closest to, the family I was closest to, is that family in the countryside.
Okay, now this is going to be an odd question that you probably were asked 8 years ago, but maybe not recently. But I'm going to ask it again. Chinese food. What is the relationship, having lived in China for a decade, between the Chinese food that you ate there, the cuisine you ate there, and what you see in America now?
Most American food is a foreign version of that. I can't eat like the Great Wall Buffet or all this stuff. I mean, but the thing I do notice is there are legitimate restaurants more and more, you know, and I know, you know, there's a bunch of them in New York. I know a very good Sichuanese place in Denver, a great one in San Diego. So there, more and more I can go to places and get legitimate Sichuanese food, which is what I loved in China because that's where I lived in the Peace Corps. So we see more of it now than we did in the past. But for the most part, it's very Americanized. It's sweeter. That's the difference. They made it sweeter for the Americans. I guess it's saltier, too. They dumbed down the spice, too, for the American market.
Right. Peter Hessler, now you're back. In an interview, you said you and your wife are now looking at the Middle East. You're done with China?
Well, we wanted to do something different for a while, and I'd like to study another language. I think that process is interesting, trying to learn a language. It's interesting to write about it. This is my third book on China. There were a set of three. They cover a decade. I felt like it's a natural point to do something different. We plan to live in China again in the future, but we'd like to do something else in the meantime.
Well, you were the New Yorker correspondent. They paid you a salary.
No, they pay me by the word.
Oh, by the word. I mean, the whole time?
Yeah. I mean, that's the way it works, and that's the way I want it to work, because I like to have my freedom. I like to pick my projects. You know, I don't have to do anything that somebody else tells me. I choose when I want to write a story, I write a story, and the same thing with books. And so that's important to me as a writer, have that freedom.
When you were working with The New Yorker, did you have any issues with them over their fact-checking?
No. I mean, the fact-checking is a great process. They call everybody. The one issue with fact-checking is that it's very hard to fact-check with somebody in rural China. They would hire somebody. I mean, they hire a Chinese speaker to call the person. But, I mean, people have it can freak somebody out, for one thing. And also, if a rural person in China doesn't want to say no, or they don't want to say, I don't know, and so they'd ask a question, and they would just sometimes just give an answer. And it would be the wrong answer. And then they'd change this detail of my story. I'd say, I know that's true, and then we'd have to go back and go around. So it's a very different process when you're dealing with people in the countryside.
Well, David Sedaris said that when the New Yorker fact-checkers got on his case, he kept saying, but wait a second, I'm writing humor. And they didn't care.
Yeah. No, they can be tough, but, I mean, it's a good process, and especially, you can put them to work. If there's something that I don't understand very well, I said, I think I should know this better than I do. Take a good look at that, and they'll do it.
Well, what are you working on now? Anything in particular?
I just finished an essay about moving back to the States, actually, that'll be in The New Yorker in a couple of weeks, and I'm working on a story about uranium mining in southwestern Colorado. So, change of pace.
One final question. If you were to speak with people in the United States government about how to approach China, what would you tell them?
I'm glad it's not my job, basically, because I love dealing with Chinese people, but I did not have to deal much with government officials. And it's really hard to deal with those guys. It's not pleasant. I think the thing about China, it's a very pragmatic society. They behave in ways that are clearly in their best interest. So I think that, for example, Taiwan, I do not expect the Chinese to invade Taiwan. It's not going to happen. They know it's not in their best interest. I think that you have to be fairly direct with them. I think you have to be careful about challenging them publicly. The Chinese do not respond well to that generally. They don't like to be embarrassed. They don't like somebody to make a public statement that makes them look bad. And I think the American government basically knows this. I think it's also true at this point that the American government has limited leverage. We do not have the leverage on China that we had 20 years ago. And I think this upsets many Americans, but in some ways it might not be a bad thing. We don't have to feel like we've got to show them what to do. They're figuring it out on their own.
But there's also issues involving the Dalai Lama in Tibet, too.
Those are really tough issues. That issue has gotten worse and worse over the years. And I think at this point, I think the Chinese, they don't want to interact at all with the Dalai Lama. There was a period 20 years ago when they were much more open to discourse. I think over time, they have decided, let's just wait until this guy dies, and then we can institute a new one. I think that's their approach. I don't see anything happening on that issue. And I don't know what the U.S. – I don't know what the best approach is. I think it was right for Obama to meet with the Dalai Lama. I think it would be bad to refuse that because the Chinese don't want to do it. But I think you have to be realistic. And at this point, China holds all the cards on Tibet. I mean, it's part of their country. It has been part of their country for 50 years. They're not going to give it up. And even when the Dalai Lama doesn't ask for independence, the Chinese just don't want to talk to him.
Peter Hessler, are you planning to buy a car?
Oh, in China? No. I would not buy a car in China right now. No, I rent it. It's great to rent in China because of all the dents, man. I didn't want to have to feel those personally. You just, when you have a dent in China, you just pull over, negotiate it, and then it's done, especially if it's a rental.
When I was in Thailand, I was with friends who lived there, and I was always, I was the bike bitch on the back. There was no way I was going to ride because there are no laws. I mean, it feels that way. Is that how it felt?
China is actually easier than Bangkok, for example. Bangkok is much more chaotic. And one reason is that in China, in the big cities like Beijing, Shanghai, you're not allowed to have motorbikes like that. So they've actually kept that out of the traffic mix, and it's much safer as a result. It's I think it's better run in some ways than Thailand.
And now you're back and you're driving again. Must be pretty easy now.
It's easy. I just got a speeding ticket for like $325 in Colorado, so I'm not happy about that. But yeah, it's a lot easier. I have caught myself making Chinese traffic moves. I mean, in China, when a light turns green and you're making a left turn, you just go. The moment it turns green, you don't let the guys going straight go. So you cut them off. And a couple times I've caught myself making that maneuver in Colorado, and I've more or less have made the transition, but there is a rehab element. Detox.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Hessler, whose latest book is Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.